Hello and welcome to another episode of Sacktown Talks. Today we have a special guest today, Daniel Wallach, a sports betting expert, legal sports betting expert, I should say, joins us today. Daniel, how you doing? Thanks for joining us.
I'm doing great, Jared. Thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to talking about one of the most topical subjects right now in California.
Yeah, you know, we first saw you here, I guess, earlier in the year during the sports betting hearing. And you gave a presentation to both the Senate and the Assembly GO hearing on, I guess, a very interesting topic of whether, you know, California needs to go to a vote of the people or whether, you know, simply a vote of the legislature could legalize sports betting. And kind of that's where we first heard about you. Can you kind of explain and kind of give us a history of you know, your background in sports betting and I guess, gaming law?
Sure. And thanks for asking. My experience in gaming law goes back to the old days of 2011 or 2012, at a time when sports betting as a possible subject for states to, you know, get into. That was the first, I think that was the first time that New Jersey really began initiating efforts to put sports betting on their ballot. Now, New Jersey has a constitution, unlike California's. California's it prohibits casinos of the type currently operating in Nevada and New Jersey, but New Jersey's constitution has a broad prohibition against all forms of gambling. So in order to bring Atlantic City's casinos to Atlantic City, that had to be done by a constitutional amendment. So back in 2011, the voters of New Jersey, I guess the legislature wanted to shore up the lost revenues during an economic downturn, and they saw sports betting as a possible solution. So it went on the ballot in New Jersey, and New Jerseyans approved it by more than a 2-1 vote. And that's kind of my point of entry in the whole debate around sports betting. And if you're a lawyer in this space, and you go back to 2011, well, that makes you the legal equivalent of Neil Armstrong for sports betting. I was one of the first ones. And then I latched on to the New Jersey litigation, and I began writing about it. And as someone with over 300 appeals, under my belt and all this federal litigation experience, it was a natural fit for me to be able to analyze these federal constitutional issues in the New Jersey sports betting case, which focused on whether Congress's enactment of PASPA unduly interfered with state sovereignty. So as an appellate lawyer by training, and as someone with a deep interest in gambling law and sports law, this was like the perfect triangle of all of my interests. So beginning with the New Jersey sports betting case, I began to develop an interest and a scholarly approach to it, where I became the go-to analyst and person that was in demand to speak about the topic. I became the expert on the case, and it eventually allowed me to, you know, transition more fully into gaming law and sports wagering law, which is what I do now. I talk to legislatures all over the country, and most of my practice is centered around gaming law. So what started as a hobby and an interest in, writing about something has become a career vocation.
Was it May of 2018, the Supreme Court basically struck down PASPA and I guess gave the states the ability to legalize sports betting. Can you kind of give us a rundown, I guess, of what states have legalized sports betting and kind of, I guess the overall view of the nation in sports betting right now?
Yeah, not to overuse the phrase gold rush, especially in a state like California, but in the 2 years since the demise of PASPA, I think some 40 states have proposed legislation to authorize sports betting within their borders. That's almost the entire country. Roughly half have succeeded, and sometimes it's taken, you know, one, two, or three efforts because you had three legislative sessions that have come and gone since the Supreme Court heard the PASPA oral argument. Now, the argument took place in December of 2017. The writing or the tea leaves were on the wall back then because it became apparent back then that PASPA was going to be overturned to any astute court watcher. And I was in the court, and we all thought that PASPA was on its way out. So beginning in January of 2018, states began lining up legislation. So some states that passed it recently were on their third attempts. Some states got it done in year two, like Illinois, and some states were successful right off the bat. So we've had, I think, 20 states post-PASPA authorize sports betting. And of that 20, 14 or 15 have actually gone forward and implemented it. Now, passing a law doesn't mean it gets activated the next day. Licenses have to be issued. Regulations have to be written. There's a gestation period roughly between, 3 and 6 months for the law to become implemented through regulations and licenses. So that's where we stand today. And the reason states like California, Texas, Florida, New York, for mobile betting, that is, some of the biggest states in the country are on the sidelines still, because we're now entering the phase where some of the big ticket states that are remaining may have either constitutional barriers or state tribal compact exclusivity issues or internal stakeholder battles. So, it would seem beyond obvious that California would be one of the most interested states, but you have barriers, legal and political, that simply didn't exist in some of the first wave states where the legislators were able to more smoothly pass the legislation without any opposition or any threat of a legal challenge.
Yesterday here in California, we had a hearing on Senate Constitutional Amendment 6, SCA 6, as they're calling it. It passed out of committee. Previously you testified in hearing that you didn't think a constitutional amendment was necessary and that the legislature could just do a simple 41 vote bill, minus the tax issue here, that could be looked at.
That's an interesting issue about the tax issue, because it does raise the question whether it would be subjected to the separate constitutional threshold of 2/3 for raising or increasing taxes. That's an open question, but that's not what I testified about in January.
Right. So I was kind of, if you could go into, I guess, your analysis or your thought process of, the 1984 lottery initiative that said, in California, no casinos can operate like Nevada, New Jersey, and kind of your thoughts of why, California doesn't actually need to go to a vote of the people to enact sports betting.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to engage in it. I think I turned quite a few heads in January when I testified on that point and advocated and laid out the reasons why the California constitutional ban on New Jersey and Nevada casinos didn't apply to sports betting. But you can't do in 8 or 9 minutes what the issue really requires in terms of persuading legislators, and more importantly, persuading the legislative council that give guidance to the state lawmakers. So if given an opportunity to testify more broadly on the issue in writing, I would point out that the 1984 lottery initiative wasn't just about the lottery. It had a second component, which included the current ban, Section 19E. It would be a prohibition on casinos of the type currently operating in Nevada and New Jersey. So definitionally, when you break down the structure of those words, what stands out? Two things. What does currently mean? What does casino mean? What does New Jersey and Nevada style casinos mean? And you really have to look back at the Supreme Court's opinion in a case called Hotel Employees, which was a legal challenge to what was known at the time as Proposition 1A, which was a legislative effort to authorize tribal casinos. Now, tribal casinos are replete throughout the state now, but that lawsuit toppled the legislative efforts to bring tribal gaming to California, and it led to another initiative, a constitutional initiative a year later. So getting back to sports betting, here's why sports betting isn't included within the ambit of Section 19E. Okay, the words Nevada and New Jersey, those are conjunctives. When you have a conjunctive, meaning the word and, the conditions, both conditions, Nevada and New Jersey have to be satisfied. And this is just level one. I mean, there are 10, 11, 12 arguments, but no one's asked me for an opinion yet, but I'm happy to give one in writing should it be necessary. So casinos of the type currently operating in Nevada and New Jersey means casinos of the type that existed in 1984 when Proposition 37, which was the initiative that created Section 19E. So you look at the state of affairs in 1984. Nevada had sports betting. New Jersey did not. So immediately, that condition precedent isn't satisfied. Now let's focus on the word casinos. casinos connotes casino type gambling. And the ballot question, or at least the ballot pamphlet that was handed out to voters, and in the Supreme Court's opinion and hotel employees in numerous locations throughout the majority opinion and the dissenting opinion, the court described the voters' intent in enacting Proposition 37A as a prohibition against casino gambling. Okay, what is casino gambling? Casino gambling is games of chance, you know, dice, slots, roulette, games that are played wholly within a casino environment and that they're determined within a casino environment. Oh, interesting. Sports betting, by contrast, takes place, or the results are determined primarily outside the four walls of a casino. And courts all over the country, or actually state attorney generals in at least six states, have concluded that sports betting is a game of skill, not a contest of chance. So it deviates from casino gambling in two very significant respects. And also, there's some debate over how the California Supreme Court interpreted Section 19E. I think some of the opponents I think some of the tribes have taken the position that this ban on New Jersey and Nevada-style casinos really means a ban on anything that's prohibited in California that takes place or is offered in a building or room, because the old dictionary definition of the word casino is a building, a room, or a facility. So the California Supreme Court, as part of its analysis, offered several alternative interpretations of what it means to be a casino of the type operating in Nevada and New Jersey. And one of the definitional approaches that it took was to look at it by association with New Jersey, and that it only speaks to games that are particularly associated with or unique to New Jersey and Nevada. That was definitional approach number one. The second approach was that the court looked at the inverse of the issue and looked to see what games were statutorily prohibited in California in 1984. So the court looked at the issue from two different angles, the facial language, Nevada and New Jersey, and then the inverse by looking at what was prohibited in California at the time. And I believe those who believe a constitutional amendment is required would take the position that sports betting is a form of bookmaking, which was outlawed in California in 1984 by virtue of the bookmaking, you know, criminal statute, Section 337 of the Penal Code. And because bookmaking was prohibited, if you put a room, building, or facility in place that offers it, then it, you know, voila, it becomes a casino, because it's a building, room, or facility which meets the definition of casino under the Webster's Dictionary definition. And then if you put a statutorily prohibited form of gambling in that building, room, or facility, it becomes a Nevada style or New Jersey style casino, which is absolutely ridiculous, because under that interpretation, the game of three card Monte played in a convenience store would meet the definition of what statutorily prohibited in California in 1984. And nobody in their right mind would equate that with a Nevada style and New Jersey style casino. So the court didn't say, well, it's California. You look at it through the prism of what's illegal in California. What the court did was evaluate it under several different definitional approaches. And the mere existence of these different definitional approaches means that the meaning of the word casinos of the type operating in Nevada and New Jersey is somewhat ambiguous. It's subject to several interpretations. It's obscure. It's not unambiguous. And when you have those conditions in place, under principles of constitutional interpretation, the legislature is afforded substantial discretion to choose the definition that it believes is more reasonable. And their decision, their choice, is accorded great deference by the California state courts and in a number of California Supreme Court opinions. So really, when you evaluate the issue, you have to look at it not only through the prism of the different approaches the Supreme Court took, but against the backdrop and under the analytical framework of constitutional principles of interpretation. Courts, what the California Supreme Court has said in a number of decisions is that constitutional restrictions or limitations on legislative authority are to be strictly and narrowly construed. And any doubts are to be resolved in favor of legislative action. And this this constitutional provision and the ambiguity surrounding the meaning of casinos in Nevada and New Jersey circa 1984 create a world of ambiguity and offer several reasonable interpretations. And those choices or those reasonable alternatives leave the legislature in a position to make a choice which will be beyond reproach, because they're accorded substantial deference, their choice is controlling, and that's the end of the story. So under principles of constitutional interpretation and the plain language and how the Supreme Court has interpreted 19E, I think it's an open and shut case. But right now we're in a position, or at least a time in California politics, where the legislature has made the policy decision that they wish to proceed by way of a ballot question, because quite frankly, it avoids the legal challenge. And it's probably the path of least resistance in 2020. But ask yourself this question: do you want to have two votes or one vote? When the first vote has to have a 66 2/3% threshold, which is getting out of the state legislature, before the people can vote on it and pass it by majority vote, that might be an insuperable barrier, given the level of tribal opposition that has been brought to bear the last couple of days. So, just simple math, one vote where you might only need a majority approval is much cleaner than going through two gauntlets where the first gauntlet requires a 66 2/3% approval. And I just point to the experience recently in Colorado and in various cities in New Hampshire. They had ballot questions. They had referenda. In New Hampshire, it was city by city. And in Colorado, it was statewide. And Colorado narrowly passed their ballot question by, I think, 50.3%. And in New Hampshire, four out of the nine city-by-city referenda turned down the chance to have retail sports books. So in those states, there was no organized opposition. There weren't any California Indian tribes throwing $40 million into advertising to block the measure. There was no organized opposition, yet they came so perilously close to failing. So now you look at the California setup, and with the tribes being vehemently opposed to this measure, and they might have very good reason to be opposed to it because of the concessions given to the card rooms, and then the real barrier, which is having to compete with mobile sports betting. So if the tribes put a lot of their energy, and more importantly, money towards blocking the measure, securing a 50% vote in November and more imminently a 2/3 vote in the legislature is not only no sure thing, but I think if I were a betting man, I would probably come out on the side of not thinking sports betting will be legal on January 1st in California.
That's an interesting point you kind of brought up. I guess the different stakeholders here in California, you got card rooms, you have racetracks, you have Indian tribes. Is this much different than, I guess, other states, and kind of what other similar states have, a similar gaming setup with similar stakeholders? And I guess what kind of model have they arrived at where everyone can agree and kind of move forward?
Well, I think there's only one state that has passed a sports betting law that has had a significant tribal gaming presence. And I'm not casting stones at the tribes. It's all stakeholders. Whenever there's a state where you have competing interests, horse racetracks, casinos, the state lottery, Indian tribes, one of the arguments that surfaces, or one of the issues, is who gets to run it? How many casinos? Who gets exclusivity? And as you enter states that have an abundance of tribal compacts with exclusivity provisions, the legal barriers become a little bit more pronounced. In Florida, for example, we're going to have a tougher time. This is my home state. We're going to have a tougher time passing a sports betting law because we do have tribal compacts with the Seminole Tribe of Florida that grant them exclusivity over all forms of Class 3 gaming, which would by definition include sports betting. So you couldn't pass a sports betting law in the state of Florida without potentially, but jeopardizing the huge, nine-figure revenue sharing payments that the Seminole Tribe pays to the state every year. So as a practical matter and as a legal matter, it's going to be very uphill climb to get anything done in Florida. And then Florida also has a constitutional provision that's broader than the no casinos, the no New Jersey casinos language in California. We have a prohibition against all casino gambling. So arguing that sports betting is not casino gambling is a little bit easier in California because it looks at the state of affairs in 1984 when there was no sports betting in New Jersey. Right. But arguing that casino gambling and sports betting are separate and distinct without a time parameter, I think the argument still stands, but not everybody agrees with that. And I think no matter what happens, if Florida tries to pass a piece of legislation that includes sports betting without amending the state constitution, there will definitely be litigation over it. I think the litigation will fail. But as you get into these states with a multitude of stakeholders with divergent interests, that's reason number one, why some states like California are on the sidelines. And then reason number two are either the existence of tribal compact exclusivity provisions and or state constitutional barriers.
One thing that you brought up is, I guess, the difference between mobile and brick and mortar. Kind of, you know, what's the significance of having mobile betting today versus just strictly brick and mortar?
Well, mobile betting accounts for, at least by virtue of the early results in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, 90% of sports betting revenues are attributable to bets placed on mobile devices. Wow. And there are lots of tracks and casinos in New Jersey, and it's a smaller state. I think there are about 14. I wouldn't say a lot, but it's a much smaller state than California. California is really, there's nothing like it in the United States. It's so populous and so geographically diffuse that a brick and mortar only environment for sports betting would come nowhere close to realizing the vast potential of California. I mean, you could bet on mobile devices in Oregon. You could bet on sports mobily in Nevada, and California borders both states. So for the citizenry of California, most of them don't live within close proximity of a tribal casino or a horse race track. So if you look at the large block of citizens that live closer to the Oregon and Nevada border than to tribal casinos or racetracks, you're not going to capture those customers. And, you know, I think most tribal casinos aren't located in major downtown metropolitan centers. And mobile is even more essential and critical to the success of sports betting in California, given your unique topography. But I would say that I like the initiative that's been proposed, but there's one element of it that I think could be changed and maybe clarified. I believe that even though mobile betting would be permitted under SCA 6, there would be that dreaded in-person registration requirement, which means that before you can activate your mobile account and start betting on your smartphone, you would need to traipse, drive, walk, whatever, to go to the nearest tribal casino or horse racetrack simply to open up an account. That is completely absurd in this day and age when any of us can shop online, can play fantasy sports online and not have to go to any physical brick and mortar facility. So I think that's one element of the plan that I think could use some refining, in my opinion. And also, I think there's a missed opportunity here because the state is so large and the casinos aren't located in downtown major metropolitan centers. I think the sports venues could have played a much more prominent role in serving as, hubs for sports betting in the state of California. I mean, in Sacramento, I mean, imagine having a multi-level sports book in your basketball arena. So unlike other states that have maybe casinos and racetracks near the bigger cities, California really does lack those major gaming infrastructures in the large cities like San Francisco, San Diego, Los Angeles. And I think this is where the professional sports arenas can play a really important part, because obviously mobile is going to take off in California. It's going to be runaway successful. It's going to put up numbers that will put New Jersey and Pennsylvania to shame. But why give up or almost think of the retail market as an afterthought? I think the horse racetracks are going to benefit immensely from sports betting. I think the tribal casinos will see an uptick in business from retail sports betting. But I don't think all those venues combined will do enough to reach the full potential of the retail market. And I think if you really want to bring people into venues and create foot traffic, I think you have to bring them to the place where the most obvious sports wagering consumer is going to be located, which is a fan attending a ball game in San Francisco, Sacramento, LA, San Diego. Millions of people walk through turnstiles in professional sports venues in California every year. And by contrast, sports books and racetracks are going to have, like tribal casinos and horse racetracks are going to have smaller footprints for their sports books. So I think California could really leverage its, what I would consider the most dominant professional sports industry in the country.
That's an interesting point you brought up about, I guess, the in-person registration requirement. You know, I assume that's there for, I guess, public safety measures to ensure age verification. I guess kind of
To be honest, it's more of a form of protectionism. Casinos and land-based stakeholders are afraid that the DraftKings and the FanDuels of the world will siphon off business from the brick and mortars. And if a customer can activate an account without having to go to a casino, that's one less person visiting the casino. So by forcing that kind of in-person registration requirement, you're at least driving a lot of traffic initially, at least, to tribal casinos and horse racetracks. So there's a real good economic reason for the land-based stakeholders to want in-person registration. But in terms of it being a public safety measure, I think that's concocted. It's probably more of an economic protectionist measure to ensure that the local land-based stakeholders aren't, crushed or stampeded by these out-of-state mobile platforms that can simply attract customers without having them, visit any particular venue. So I think it's really a matter of survival and a matter of fair competition, at least from the perspective of the stakeholders.
You know, I guess yesterday we heard, some comments on, the public safety issue of children and gaming and mobile gaming. Kind of what known protections are out there, to prevent underage gaming and to ensure that the people who are actually placing the wager are the ones, of age and able to play?
Well, I think there's much more KYC safeguards in a mobile environment. You can go to a casino and place a bet at a sports book and only one person is going to check. If they check and if they adequately check. Once everything is done online, this verification up and down the line, photo ID, credit card, they go through a vetting process to really limit the risk of underage gambling. So I think the internet offers more protections in that fashion than does in-person wagering because of the electronic nature of the surveillance and the multiple ways that electronic verification can be done across many platforms and databases that doesn't exist when you're going to a window at a racetrack. So you can never eliminate or mitigate the risk entirely, but I think the mobile and internet betting environment offers more in the way of safeguards than has ever existed in the gambling industry.
You brought up,
but it's also risk. I'm not running away from that. But I think it does if the right safeguards and protocols are put in place under the state laws, and you have responsible operators who are complying with state regulations and state statutes. I think the risk of finding 13-year-olds betting on the Rose Bowl online are going to be mitigated. There haven't been too many stories like that, or any stories that I've heard like that in the 2 years since PASPA was overturned. That just simply hasn't surfaced as a not only not a severe problem, but not even a small problem in any of the reports that I've heard.
I know, betting in sports arenas is very prevalent in, Europe. Are you aware of any states who've legalized or authorized, sporting arenas to take bets at this point?
Yeah, it's the latest trend. Washington, D.C. Passed a sports betting bill in January. I mean, it's not a state, but I'm getting to state. So in January 2019, the District of Columbia authorized a sports betting law that allowed sports betting at four professional sports venues, including the Capital One Arena, where the NBA's Washington Wizards and the NHL's Washington Capitals play their games. And the Capital One Arena is owned by entrepreneur, you know, Ted Leonsis. And Ted Leonsis has been at the forefront of the intersection of sports and sports gambling. And he has entered into a partnership with one of the largest sports book operators in the United States to create what will become probably the biggest show palace for sports betting in the U.S. So there will be a William Hill branded sports book at the Capital One Arena. The pandemic has slowed down, I think, the opening date, but by the end of 2021, you'll be able to place bets at the building while you're attending games. And even when you're not attending games, because there'll be entrances that allow people to come in from the outside to wager at the sportsbook. So DC is one, Illinois is another. You'll be able to soon see betting, sports betting at Soldier Field, Wrigley Field, the United Center. Kentucky is another state that has introduced legislation to allow sports betting at some of the sports venues. Virginia recently passed a sports betting law that would have authorize a sports book to be hosted at an NFL stadium, and that was seen as an inducement to the Washington Redskins to have them build their new stadium in the Commonwealth of Virginia. New York is another state that over the last 2 years has introduced legislation to allow sports betting at pro sports venues seating at least 15,000 people. So that would mean Madison Square Garden, the Nassau Coliseum, Yankee Stadium. But that's right now only a measure. It's not legislation. But I think that's one of the more recent trends that I'm seeing, that it really makes sense when you think about it, given who your target audience is. You're much more likely to find a sports bettor at a ball game, because that's where sports enthusiasts go, than you would find them in a casino or in a horse racetrack. So I think it recognizes the scale of these buildings, not just their locations. Obviously, the downtown locations are very important for a venue like Madison Square Garden. It sits atop the busiest rail station in the Western Hemisphere, which is Penn Station. You're talking about millions of people within close proximity every week. You can turn the lights on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But beyond just the geographic desirability, they also bring something much more important to the fold, which is their scale, their size. Forget a 200-person sports book in a casino. You could actually have a multi-level venue in which a couple thousand people can sit around and watch games on a big screen and enjoy, you know, wagering on sporting events. So the proximity to downtown centers, the size of these venues, coupled with the sports-focused nature of what these buildings bring to the table, it just seems to me to be the most natural outlet to host sports wagering. And it's been more the exception than the rule, and I'd like to see it become more of the rule. Because I think California in particular would really see, just jumbo-sized results from its retail market if you brought the, NFL stadiums, the NHL stadiums, NBA stadiums, MLB, stadiums into the fold. You bring those 20 or so facilities online, or not literally online, but you bring them into the sports betting ecosystem. That's millions of potential customers that may not otherwise be traveling to a casino or a racetrack. It just seems obvious to me. And depending on how this legislation fares to place the issue on the ballot in November, maybe this is an issue that could be revisited next year through legislation. However, California is a very it's a treacherous environment politically, with a lot of delicate balancing to do, considering the card rooms' interests, the tribes, the racetracks. It's a difficult state for progressive legislation. So let me put it that way. It's going to be easier said than done.
You brought up, I guess, this delicate balance. I guess one thing that has kind of come to our attention, or may or may not, the issue of tribal governments and mobile gaming. Are there any, I guess, federal law or federal barriers to entry for tribes to enter into mobile gaming from their reservations, I guess, to the state as a whole?
Yeah, that's a very under the radar issue, because I think it requires an understanding of the federal law that governs Indian gambling on Indian lands. It's called the Indian Gambling Regulatory Act, and its jurisdictional reach is gambling on Indian lands. So under IGRA, which is the law that breathes life into tribal gaming. All the compacts that states have to enter into under IGRA and are approved by the U.S. Secretary of the Interior, all that can govern is gaming on Indian land. And mobile betting is arguably not gambling on Indian land. It arguably is, because if the server is located at a casino and the customer is located, you know, off the casino, there is a line of authority under state contract law and gambling law generally that can lead to a conclusion that that off reservation gaming is actually gambling on Indian lands, because the bet is processed on the reservation on a server located at the casino on the Indian reservation. Unfortunately, that argument has been rejected by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, or at least one of the other satellite agencies that regulate Indian gaming, you know, in Washington, D.C. And they've issued regulatory opinions that have rejected the concept of mobile betting being deemed gaming on Indian lands. So if mobile betting isn't covered by IGRA, then that's not an activity that the tribes can enter into amended compacts to be able to do, because the federal government won't sign off on the compact. And you need to have the U.S. Secretary of the Interior to approve a compact agreed to between the state and the tribe. So if the federal government won't sign off based upon this regulatory authority and these opinions, these administrative opinions that find mobile betting to be outside the bounds of IGRA, then the only alternative left for the tribes is to be treated and to operate as commercial operators and get gambling licenses. Remember, I want to emphasize, the tribes are not prohibited from getting a gambling license. What they ideally would like to do is have this gambling activity folded into their compacts under IGRA, because under this federal law, the state can't tax Indian tribes. State can't regulate Indian tribes. You know, there might be revenue sharing built into the compact, but one of the advantages of a compact is insulation from taxation and insulation from burdensome oversight. Once the tribes become commercial operators and have to get gambling licenses, then they have to pay taxes, just like every other casino, every other card room. The tax rate that applies to the commercial entity will now apply to the tribes. So I don't think they want to do that. And the other obstacle for the tribes when it comes to mobile is the competitive aspect of mobile. Right? Because not only is there a legal question as to whether they can do it under IGRA and have that activity on Indian land under their amended compacts, but they are also worried about the cannibalization of their land-based tribal casino activities. Because if mobile betting is authorized on a statewide basis and other entities are allowed to enter into the marketplace, like the big online betting companies, it will draw a lot of revenues away from the tribal casinos. Even if the tribes are allowed to operate mobile betting, they'll have competition for the first time. In the realm of Class 3 gambling in California, right now the tribes have exclusivity as to certain forms of Class 3 gambling under the Proposition 1A that was enacted in the year, I think, 2000. But they don't have Class 3 wide exclusivity. So if the tribes want to engage in sports betting, they want to have exclusivity over it on Indian land and don't want the competition from mobile. Because if out of state interests are able to enter the California marketplace, it will be competitive and really competitive with the product that the tribes are offering. So I think it's really a matter of competition, as well as the legal issue as to whether and to what extent the tribes can actually offer mobile betting.
Earlier, you were talking about, I guess, sports teams and their interest in seeing legalized sports betting pass. I know when sports betting, you know, first came out in 2018, leagues were looking for integrity fees. They seem to back off that. Kind of what are the league's interests in seeing legalized sports betting?
The more it's brought out of the shadows and brought into a transparent environment, the less conceivably there's less of an integrity threat if you move sports gambling from the illegal market and you bring it into a legal regulated market where the activity can be monitored better. So at a surface level, legal sports betting can actually promote integrity. But the reason why the leagues have been asking for a royalty, you called it an integrity fee. I think they called it that for all of 1 month. It's actually called a royalty. And they haven't been successful yet in securing it from any state, although New York State will likely have a royalty built into the package for the leagues. And I believe other states are considering it as well. And what the leagues, I think, argue, not incorrectly, is that legalizing sports betting and adding all these new customers to the ecosystem will actually counterintuitively increase the league's exposure to match fixing and increase their oversight expense and increase their monitoring expense. Because if you're taking a certain level of gambling that's taking place, in the shadows, and by making sports betting legal, you're going to be dramatically escalating the scale of sports betting that takes place in both legal and illegal markets. That just the sheer quantity of the betting that takes place will go up immeasurably if it becomes, legislatively authorized. So with more betting would become more transactions, more opportunities, more incentives to fix matches. And I think the leagues are taking the view that this is their product, because without the sporting events, without their staging of the games, there's no activity to bet on. And we're seeing that today. You remove the games, due to COVID-19, the sports books aren't going to make any money on U.S. sports. They're going to have to turn to U.S. They're going to have to turn to table tennis and turkey, these minor league or lower caliber sports in other parts of the world. So the leagues believe that as the inventors and creators of the product, that they're entitled to some direct level of participation in the economic upside of sports betting, particularly when you consider that they will have added expense and added exposure from this activity being brought into the marketplace, albeit legally. So that's their position, but I think they've made it less of a priority in the recent legislative session than they've emphasized another issue instead, which is official data. And the leagues are at the forefront of trying to lobby state legislatures to require gambling operators to buy their live data feeds from the leagues, because as more and more of the sports betting takes place in play within the context of a game, the speed, reliability, and verifiability of this data, which travels at milliseconds, becomes so essential to protecting the integrity of the betting environment that the leagues have the live feed, and they have the best official data, the best data that sports books would be able to take full advantage of for a price. Without official data being mandated in state statutes, what the leagues fear is that a number of gambling operators wouldn't see the need to buy official data, or they'll try to get it through other less reliable means, and it will create a hodgepodge of different gambling operators, some that have official data, some that don't have anything, and it could create a real integrity problem within the in-game wagering market. So the leagues would like to see that baked into the legislation, and the California bill that was updated last week by Senator Dodd includes an official data requirement. So I think that's become more of a trend in sports betting legislation, as the integrity fee has kind of gone to the sidelines and given way to the official data requirement. And it's more the rule than the exception that you see official data in some of the newer sports betting bills.
Dan, we're going to ask you to take out your crystal ball here for a second, I guess. And tell us kind of what you see as the future of sports betting here in California. As you know, we had a tribal initiative that I guess appears stalled at the moment due to the pandemic. And then you have Senator Dodd's proposed initiative. And how do you see, I guess, the sports betting, ending up later this year?
Well, unless one has inside knowledge, it's really difficult to project what will happen, because there are so many unknowns. Let's take a look at the tribal initiative. Back in February, March, they were well on their way to securing the 997,000 signatures that they needed by the end of April. I think the real deadline was later in June. It's an unknown at this point how many signatures they've gathered. By some reports, they have close to 1 million. By others, closer to 600,000. And some of the recent statements that have come out of their spokesperson suggest that they will litigate with the state of California over any refusal to extend the signature gathering deadline, because there is certainly on a level some type of inherent unfairness in imposing a hard and fast deadline when it wasn't possible for the tribes to gather signatures for more than a 2-month period. So it remains to be seen whether they have any legal leg to stand on that issue and how close they are to securing 1 million signatures. I would, if I had to predict, and I'm telling you, there's so many caveats here, we just don't know, I would think that that measure will not get on the November ballot. But even if it does get on the November ballot, so too can the legislative initiative get on the ballot. And whichever one draws the most votes is the one that's left standing. You could have two sports betting referenda on your November ballot, and the one that draws the most votes is actually the one that gets enacted. I would seem to, given my experience of predicting bills being passed into law, I've been burned a couple of times recently. I'm gung-ho and enthusiastic. I would think it's probably going to be status quo. The tribal measure looks like it will fall short because of the signature gathering issue and the approaching deadline. And with the California legislature needing to have 2/3 of lawmakers in both chambers approving the placement of the issue on the ballot, I think given the power and influence of the tribes in Sacramento, that 2/3 threshold is going to be really difficult to achieve, notwithstanding the 9-3 vote that took place yesterday, where I think the result was a little bit more certain. So I think we're probably heading to an environment where you and I are going to be having the same conversation in January of 2021, and I'm going to be telling you why it's such an excellent idea for the state legislature to authorize sports betting through a statutory enactment. And we're going to have the same issues that permeated the informational hearing in January resurface again in January of 2021. So my bet would be status quo, nothing will change, although it's closer now than it's ever been for California.
Yesterday during the testimony, I don't know if you had a chance to watch the hearing, but there was, I guess, a lot of back and forth, mainly on the card room issue and the card rooms, getting, I guess, statutory clarity, constitutional clarity on the games they play. I know in the state of Florida, I think similar card rooms or card games are played. And I guess, if you could, predict or find a middle ground between the tribes, card rooms and tracks, how could you, make a deal to make all this come together? Find a pathway for them to agree on moving forward.
You already have it. SCA 6 is that compromise. In a negotiation, everybody has to compromise. The card rooms have compromised by abandoning or abdicating sports betting just to be able to keep what they have. Right. The racetracks get something good. They get sports betting plus mobile. The tribes get sports betting plus the prospect of mobile if they want it. So there's something that everyone gets. I think the tribes seem to really have as a sticking point anything that the card rooms get in return. They want to shut the card rooms down. And in the spirit of that, mindset, it's difficult to reach compromise. And I don't know if you're going to see a turnabout in how the tribes approach SCA 6. I think their statements on the record pretty much reflect how they feel about what the card rooms are able to do or not able to do. And if you recall, a key feature of the tribe's citizen initiative basically gave the tribe's attorney general powers to enforce violations of California's gambling laws against the card rooms. They wanted to have the authority built into the state constitution to be able to go after their arch nemesis. This SCA 6 removes that feature, and not only removes it, but actually legislatively endorses the activity that the California Indian tribes wanted the power to be able to prosecute. So that's like doing a complete 180. But I think this is as much of a middle ground as you're ever going to get. Maybe you can move on some issue, but what more can the card rooms abdicate on? They've already given up sports betting. Are they going to give up designated player games too? What's in it for them? So the opposition from the California tribes presupposes that the card room shouldn't get anything. And that's a really difficult ground from which to find middle ground. So I don't think it's going to get done. I think this is probably the bill. I think Dodd has gone on record as saying he's kind of open to refinements and revisions. And like most bills that pass through state houses all across the country, they get amended and modified on the way to a floor vote. And this will probably be no exception because there are some gaps that still need to be filled in. And there are some key issues that the stakeholders aren't on board with. Well, so passing something is better than nothing, but we don't know what that something is going to look like yet. But I think this was a strong effort at finding a middle ground.
Well, Dan, thank you so much. You gave us a lot to digest there. Great information. Thanks for joining us. Can you give us, I guess, a moment to know how we can reach out to you and kind of follow you online?
Yeah, I'm a legal analyst for The Athletic, but I also have my own gaming law practice. The website for that is sportsgaminglaw.com. And I also am pretty active on Twitter. So my Twitter handle, where I often comment on sports gambling issues, is Wallach Legal, WALLACHLEGAL. That's also my email address if you throw an at gmail.com at the end of that. So that's wallachlegal@gmail.com. So thank you for giving me a chance to, plug my various platforms.
No problem. Thanks for joining us. Interesting stuff. And we look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you so much, Jared. This was enjoyable. This is one of my favorite subjects. And getting back into the swing of California was invigorating. I might have to come back.
Yeah, I guess we could use your help on a multitude of issues here. Constitutional.
Well, when you have Senator Dodd on the show, you have to like replay some of my interview, or at least tell him to take
a
look at it.
Last dance. We'll take the iPad and we'll give it to him. Say.
Okay. Thank you. Anyway, it was awesome. Thanks for having me on. I'm happy anytime you want to have me back.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Some are called dreamers.
Como